employers created more jobs than expected in October, even in the face of a labor strike at General Motors. 128,000 new jobs were added.
Consumer spending rose marginally in September, while the Fed's preferred inflation gauge came in at its weakest reading since January. The data coming after the Federal Reserve cut interest rates by a quarter point yesterday.
I think we have a political question, which is relevant to also the markets. Between now and the elections, we're probably going to have very different policies, but policies maybe more of the left and policies more of the right, more extreme policies. Okay. And how those choices are made is going to be very important to not only the size of the deficits, but the nature of taxation.
This is the Financial Sense News Hour. Now, here's the Financial Sense News Team, Jim Poplava and Chris Prytower.
Well, the Fed cuts interest rates for the third time this year. It looks like they're undoing everything they did last year. Great unemployment picture as jobs created in the economy. 128,000 jobs created last month. Dems trying to remove the president from office through impeachment, but the market loves the news. Hi, everyone. I'm Jim Poplava, and welcome to this week's Financial Sense News Hour with the markets. Major indexes in record territory. Erin Swinlan from StockCharts.com and Decision Point will be joining me as she talks about her weekly indicators just turned positive this Friday. And later on in the program, Mike McClone from Bloomberg will be here, and he is very bullish on gold. It's kind of hard to find anybody that isn't these days. All of that and Ryan Poplava, what moved the markets this week, coming up in today's program.
We welcome Ryan Poplava back into the studio to let us know what moved the markets this week. And Ryan, some interesting things happened this week. The S&P 500 was up 1.5% and the NASDAQ composite was up 1.7%. They both set record highs. So at week's end, 8 of the 11 S&P 500 sectors were up, with the value-oriented healthcare sector up 3%. And that's rising above the cyclical information technology, which was up 2.1%. And industrials up 2%, financials up 1.5%. Well, Ryan, start us off on the catalysts this week.
Thanks, Chris. There was a few themes really propelling the advance for U.S. stocks. And I think some of that is rubbing off on global markets. You know, you've seen some of them are moving up to new highs as well. You recall last Friday that the U.S. Treasury mentioned they're close to finalizing the Phase 1 trade agreement with China. And, you know, we got more information on that, such as this: the Chinese were dialing back on how much agriculture they're willing to buy right now. I think they're trying to hold things back here because they know they're not going to get a whole bunch in maybe a phase two. So maybe leaving some room for, they know that they want to see the U.S. pull back on some tariffs. So they're saying, hey, you want us to give the full $50 billion in purchases, scale back more on your tariffs. So that Friday set the S&P 500 within 3 points of a record. Intraday, it actually did breach above it. But, we came right within the right at the cusp of it. Fast forward to this week, you know, Monday, good trade vibration spilled over. And that was being felt with a Chinese report saying that they were agreeing to that progress. So both sides saying we're making progress made on the technical text of the agreement. And Trump saying they're ahead of schedule. So that optimism really led things up and helped close the S&P 500 to a all-time high. There was some weakness Thursday on poor showing from the Chinese manufacturing PMI data, which fell slightly to 49.3 from 49.8. As services were dropped as well to 52.8. So a little weakness in those economic numbers. And then here in the U.S., the Chicago Manufacturing Purchasing Managers Index, that's what PMI stands for, further declined to 43.2. in October. So little worries of that. Plus, you know, we've had some nice moves up in the markets and maybe a little bit of profit taking at these all-time highs, maybe a little doubt that we're going to head much further. And so that kind of led into the weakness on Thursday. So a slight rally in treasuries on that, but kind of giving you some economic feedback as well as if we look at, I think the other item causing that profit taking was the Chinese were doubtful. There was a report that the Chinese were doubtful of any phase two agreement forming, which with Trump. So trade, mainly on Monday, And Thursday, sprinkled with a little bit of economic news there. So the next big catalyst, what has helped move the markets to these all-time highs progressively through this week, the next one was the Federal Open Market Committee policy statement and conference call with Powell on Wednesday. Now, the policy directive, Chris, was it was initially hawkish. We got a rate cut, right? But it was a hawkish rate cut because they removed language that they were willing to act as appropriate to sustain the expansion. So basically saying, hey, we gave it to you right now instead of waiting till December. We're not so inclined to lowering rates this year. You know, that caused federal funds futures to drop the outlook for the rate cut for December. If you look at how we finished by the end of the week, the probability right now of a December cut is 12.5%. So very, very low. But where the market took off was at the suggestion that the Fed Chair Powell at the press conference said that the Fed would have to see a significant move higher in interest rates to raise interest rates. So lower for longer. You know, we're not going to lower interest rates anymore, but we're definitely in no hurry to raise interest rates. You know, can we make, I don't know, Chris, can we make a financial acronym for that? Let's call it, lower for longer. Let's call it LOFOLO.
Yeah, well, you know, Ryan, we've got FANGs, FOMO, PIGS.
Acronym for everything.
There's an acronym. Why not LOFOLO? And, you know, so, yeah, folks, you heard that here first, LOFOLO. You know, Ryan, you said that there were a few catalysts. What do you think about the jobs number? It definitely was a big headline. It seemed to lift things nicely on Friday, and it finished at the week's high.
Yeah, you know, even despite the GM strike, payrolls increased steadily by 128,000. And another report that also came out on Friday was the ISM's manufacturing index. Going back for the last 2 months, we've seen contraction in that reading, and that's really worried the bulls and really helped invigorate some of the recessionary calls. So now the reading below 50. Let's take a look at what October came in at. It came in at 48.3. While that was below the consensus, it was viewed as not getting any worse. It actually ticked up slightly from September. So the trend is still down for many months, going back to, I think, last year where the deceleration started. And so we'll need to see some further strength to remove immediate concerns, but it's definitely a tick in the right direction. So earnings this week, Chris, was another a catalyst, I think, was interesting at the micro level. Not really. You know, did one company earnings really excite everyone and really start the movement of the market? It was mainly macro. It was the Federal Open Market Committee rate cut, as well as, you know, that we're going to be lower for longer, good jobs number, and, you know, good vibrations in trade. But let's take a look at some of these names because, you know, again, we're still seeing some very active announcements in earnings. And so looking at what we saw take place, a lot of IPO names, you know, that have come out this year. We got Uber, Lyft, many others. But some of these this week missed the mark, according to investors. And if you look at some of those disappointments, let's take a look. So there was Beyond Meat, Pinterest, and Lyft were some of the more out blaring disappointments. And then we also had some other weak stocks like Twilio, Grubhub, Etsy, and Wayfair here were some of the higher beta growth names that got sold this week due to earnings. On the flip side, you know, Spotify, another growth name, reported a surprise profit. So lifting that stock and solid investor responses to those earnings announcements. Also in blue chip stocks, so and especially blue chip value names, like take a look at Pfizer, Xerox, Ingersoll Rand, GM, Kellogg, Mattel, GE, Apple, Facebook, Exxon, the list goes on. And of course, Apple supplier Qorvo. These were all great earnings reports with positive responses by investors, really linking on these maybe some deep value names. Apple, I don't know if it's deep, deep value at this point at new highs, but you know, I might have missed some names in there. But overall, yeah, very active week. The theme sort of continues out of growth or high, maybe some high beta names and into value. You know, there was also some mergers and acquisition excitement this week as Fitbit was acquired by Alphabet. And there was chatter actually at the beginning of the week that might be taking place. And then Tiffany & Co. received an unsolicited offer from LVMH. And I think that's a French company. And a nice contract win for Microsoft early in the week that they got about a $10 billion cloud contract from the Department of Defense. So again, three themes, like I already said, the FOMC, trade, and economic data better than expected.
Well, always good to hear when things are better than expected than the other way around. Ryan, thanks again for stopping by. premium members are able to hear the weekday Financial Sense Insider. That features interviews with top economic commentators and experts. If you're not a member, here's what you missed.
We have this really interesting structure of industrial policy that's playing out that's very different than what you see anywhere else on the globe in the modern era. It is indirect. It is kind of, in some ways, accidental. President Eisenhower never declared, "I shall build a science city in Silicon Valley or in Northern California." But yet, that's effectively what happened. All this money is happening because we're, you know, racing to the moon with the Soviets. We're trying to build, you know, win the Cold War. And yet, there are all of these market impacts that were unanticipated. And some of those things, because they were unanticipated, that's why we have some of the negative impacts that we have of these tech companies, kind of particularly in the modern era, growing very, very large in a mostly unregulated environment.
Global economies are slowing down. Central banks are starting another easing cycle, and interest rates are heading lower. Do you know how lower interest rates will impact your income if you're retired or about to retire? Make sure you're prepared. Work with Financial Sense Wealth Management to help you develop a plan that provides you with predictable income no matter what happens in the markets. Don't take chances with your future. Let us show you how to avoid falling interest rates and loss of income. Call Financial Sense Wealth Management now at 888-486-3939. Let's work together to create a better path to your financial future. Call 888-486-3939 today. Advisory services offered through Financial Sense Advisors, Inc., a registered investment advisor. Securities offered through Financial Sense Securities, Inc., member FINRA SIPC. Both companies doing business as Financial Sense Wealth Management.
Well, a lot of news coming out this week. The Fed cuts interest rates for the third time. The market seems to like that, and liquidity is the major indexes head into record territory. Joining me on the program to discuss what this means is Aaron Swindlin from StockCharts. Aaron, I wonder if you would share with our listeners, you put out what is called the Decision Point Scoreboard, where you look at the S&P, the S&P 100, the NASDAQ, and the Dow, and you have two categories. You have trend model signals and PMO signals, and you break that down into short-term, medium-term, and long-term. All your major indexes on the market signals are all in uptrend. So let's begin with that.
Okay, yes. So the trend model signals in each category, the short-term ones are based on 5 and 20-day EMA crossovers. So if the 5 goes above the 20, that's going to give you a buy signal, and all four of those indexes have that. The midterm are 20, 50-day EMA crossovers. So the fact they have buy signals means that their 20-day EMAs are above their 50-day EMAs. And the long-term one is pretty easy because the 50 crossing above the 200, that would be your buy. And of course, the reverse would be true for a sell signal. And we actually have just come up with a new couple of indicators that are on stock charts now called the Silver Cross Indicator and the Golden Cross Indicator. And that basically takes all of those components, for example, in the S&P 500, and tells you how many of them are on intermediate term trend model buy signal, a silver cross being a 20-50-day crossover. And then we have a Golden Cross Index, and that is based on the components in whatever index you're looking at and tells you what the number or percentage is for those with a 50 above their 200. And that's actually been something we've been watching very closely, especially with us hitting these new all-time highs. So that's the trend model signals that you see on those scoreboards. And you can find those right on the stockcharts.com homepage. You can look for those DP signal boards, and that's where you can find those.
Yeah, let me talk about something else, because all your trend model signals for all the indexes, short-term, medium-term, long-term, are all pointing up.
Yes.
You have something called the PMO signal in the midterm and the long term, at least up until today, have been pointing down for all major indexes. Explain what that signal does and how that has changed this week.
Okay. Well, the price momentum oscillator signals are based on crossovers above and below the signal lines. So for the short-term ones, that's on a daily chart. So that tells you right now they're on buy signals. So all of those PMOs are above their signal lines. The midterm you find on the weekly PMO. So on the weekly chart, you would look at the price momentum oscillator. And when you get those positive crossovers, that would be a buy signal on the weekly chart. And as you alluded to, today we just got that our weekly signals go final on the last trading day of the week when it closes. So as of today, those midterm PMO signals have all turned up. So we now have buy signals in the intermediate term for the PMO. The long term is based on the monthly PMO. And that one is really important to me. I really base a lot of my analysis on where that monthly PMO is. And if you go back and look at some of the charts that we have, you know, the monthly charts, and you look at those PMOs, they don't get a lot of crossovers on the monthly chart. They move very slowly. You don't get a lot. And when I went back in history, because we had gotten a sell signal, I think it was in August on one and three of them on September, when you get those negative crossovers and you match it to the price action, they are very, very good at predicting those market tops. And, you know, going into December of last year, we had a lot of those turn to sell signals. So actually, I'm looking at the scoreboards right now. On November 30th of 2018, that's when the S&P 500 got that negative crossover. And of course, we know what followed in December. So they are really good signals. I have been looking at those charts, and those monthly PMOs are turning back up. And that's a good thing. But I do like to watch for the crossovers first, which is why I've been pretty cautious lately about the markets in general.
So now that you've got, let's say, the weeklies turning positive, would you look for the long terms to follow suit?
Typically, yes, they will. But like I said, they are really slow movers. And, you know, in fact, so slow that, you know, if you counted since we've been tracking these since, oh my gosh, I think we go back to the 1920s. Or before, we've only had on that monthly chart for the PMO crossovers about 20 signals, buy and sell. So they are slow movers, but I think they really hit those major market tops. And, you know, seeing those weekly PMOs this week turning up, it does make me feel a bit better about the market being able to continue a rally past these all-time highs. But there are still a lot of concerns I have. I've got some really bad negative divergences on my short-term Swendlandt trading oscillators. Breadth hasn't really been there. Although I have to say, I looked at some of the charts today and, you know, the breadth, the net advance declines, new highs, all of that actually kind of came in where I would expect to see it on a nice rally day. But the 2 days we hit new all-time highs, those indicators were just flat. There just wasn't much there. So I just couldn't say I had confidence in a continuation of this move to the upside.
I want to talk about something that you feature on Stock Charts. It's one of my favorite go-to pages, and that's your market analysis page, major markets. And in there, you have the S&P Spider sectors broken down. Now, up until recently, Aaron, it's been mainly consumer staples. It's been utilities, it's been REITs, and then maybe technology. But now we have some of the other sectors breaking out. We've got financials breaking out, healthcare breaking out. As you look at the S&P and the sectors themselves, what is the message you're getting there?
Well, I did actually look this morning and see over the past month, you can go to we have a sector summary on stockcharts.com that you can go to, and you can change the period on it. And looking at just the past month of the sector rotation, I did notice three of the major defensive sectors, the ones that have really been performing, the sectors where I'm getting a lot of hits on my scans for stocks. I do a diamonds report if anybody wanted to take a look at that. It's in the articles tab on Stock Charts under Decision Point. But I'm still finding a lot of those defensive stocks coming up. But right now, real estate, staples, and utilities are as far as the last month, in last place. In fact, with utilities having lost it looks like 3/4% in the last month. So we're certainly seeing that that rotation that we want to see to support a rally like this in the broad markets. And, you know, looking at just the last week, healthcare, technology, financials, as you mentioned, they're all in that top area with utilities, real estate, energy, and staples all in last place.
Another feature on this page, you also cover international markets, currencies, and interest rates. I wonder if you might comment, international seems to be breaking out. And, you know, that has always been a laggard over the last couple of years, the U.S. market outperforming foreign markets. But now we're seeing a pickup in the international markets, which confirms our internal PMIs have bottomed and turned up, which I think is being reflected in these stock charts.
Yeah, I do. I have a chart and it basically has the DAX, the TSX, UK, French CAC, you know, Nikkei. And what I've been featuring on that is the fact that with, for example, the German DAX, UK would be another great example, and the Shanghai, they're still in a declining trend in the long term from their bull market highs. Back when we hit, you know, in early 2018, when we hit some new all-time highs, that's when those markets were breaking out. But most of those are still in a declining trend. They're still technically in a bear market. But we have seen those breakouts. The Nikkei is starting to break out. It's not close to challenging its all-time highs yet from, looks like September of 2018. UK is trying to break out of that bear market trend. TSX had gotten up there, you know, and broken out with us on that last move that we almost hit an all-time high. But they're still struggling now to get back up there to that all-time high. They haven't broken out like we have. But German DAX, they've broken out of that bear market trend. The Nikkei certainly is starting to perform better. And India, the Nifty 50, is getting ready to challenge its all-time highs from back in May.
Final two sectors. Let's talk about the bond market. It's hard to believe at the beginning of the year, we were at 3.25 on the 10-year note. And here on this Friday, we're down to about 1.7. We got down to a low of almost 1.4. Bonds started to go up again. It looks like they're rolling over. What's your take on interest rates here?
You know, with the interest rate, I think that having lowered them has certainly been a bit of a boost here, but I know people would like to see them move lower. I'm not really a fan of that myself, but I think that because we have seen some of those lower interest rate, of course, I think it has depressed the bond market somewhat. You know, I follow the TLT, the 20-plus year Treasury bond ETF, and it is starting to turn back around. I mean, I had a neutral signal come in on my trend model for TLT and bonds, but we're now starting to see a bit of a breakout, and the 20 is heading back up there to try and cross it in a positive way. And our PMO is in very oversold territory, but it has turned up. So, you know, I'm looking for bonds to start performing better than they have been pretty much in October.
And finally, let's take a look at commodities. It seems like it's a bifurcated market. If you're in gold and silver, platinum, you're probably doing okay. But, you know, you take a look at oil and copper, they've been struggling.
Absolutely. And, you know, I cover USO on Wednesdays. Carl Swenlin, my father, covers them on Fridays. And, you know, we've been looking at USO and WTIC, the West Texas crude. And, you know, they've actually been in a rising trend channel for October. We tested it, tried to actually drop below that channel, to rising trend channel, but now it's popped back up. I mean, of course, I'm not sure how many people who realize, but today, Friday, it's, you know, it was up almost 3.5%, USO was. So I think it's going to continue in its upswing here in that rising trend channel. But overall, you know, it's been in a trading range. We haven't gotten a whole lot of action there except for, you know, being tugged around as it's gone from, you know, with UUP, it's been 1050 to about 1325. And so I'm kind of looking for that continuation in that rather wide trading range. But at this point, I think it's looking pretty good. I don't have buy signals quite yet on the trend models for USO, but the PMO did give us a PMO buy signal in about mid-October, and it's now finally above zero and in positive territory. So I think actually oil is looking pretty good right now.
And then finally, let's talk about gold.
Oh, yes. Yes, you did mention that. I've been a fan of gold for quite a while. I think a lot of the technicians have. And of course, we've been in this declining trend channel since about the beginning of September is when we hit that top. But the way it has been traveling in that declining trend channel, I've been looking at it as a flag on a very nice flagpole that started in May and worked its way up. And it's just not been able to break out, but we did see that breakout yesterday. It looks like today it did pull back, but it's still outside of that declining trend channel. So I think gold is finding favor. I've got a PMO buy signal that just came in, and just like oil, it's now in positive territory. The chart looks really good to me. I would be looking for gold to make a move back up and challenge that high that we saw back in September pretty soon here, especially if this rally in the broad markets starts to struggle or fail somewhat, or just start to look a little bit shifty.
So given your trend signals, your PMOs, as you mentioned, the weekly turned positive as of today, as an investor, would you stay invested at this point? I mean, I just looking at the charts, it's really difficult to find.
It does look pretty good.
Yeah, it's hard to find anything that would make you negative.
Well, I have, but I have to say, I do write this diamonds report. I give people five stocks that I think look good from one of my exclusive decision point scans. And, you know, we're still getting some pretty good stocks coming in there. But as I've told my readers, you know, so far I haven't been really interested in adding positions right now. I'm sitting at about 60% cash. I have to say, after today's move, I am feeling a lot better. And Carl reminded me yesterday that we are now entering a 6-month period of favorable seasonality. So I'm starting to feel a little bit better about what's going on here, especially with today's breakout. I might start thinking about adding new positions here soon, but currently I think I would just hold with, you know, some reasonable stops out there. Like I said, I'm not really ready to add, but I'm a pretty cautious person. I'm more of an intermediate term investor. And like I said, Carl and I do tend to be on the cautious side about all of this. And, you know, I like the breakout that we've seen on these all-time highs. I thought yesterday's action was a bit suspicious. But, you know, it closed that gap on Wednesday. Yeah, Wednesday, it closed that gap that I was thinking we were looking at a reverse island. It closed that and moved itself right back up. And of course, today we had a really nice breakout. It's kind of hard to argue this. And, you know, I've been looking at an ascending triangle on the S&P. So again, that's a very bullish formation. We're getting the breakout like you're supposed to get. So at this point, it's starting to get a little bit difficult to not be a cheerleader here. But I have to see my short-term indicators. Like I said, you just would have to see that chart. You can find it again on the articles tab. Just go to Decision Point. I wrote about it on Wednesday. But our Swendland trading oscillators, I mean, if you see that chart, they're steeply in decline. The tops are. And yet we've seen new all-time highs and we're seeing this rally. It just really still gives me pause as far as, you know, the longevity of what we're seeing. I mean, it's been a great rally in October. I mean, there's really no arguing that, but maybe at this point it's starting to get to its last legs. But gosh, you know, like I said, we're starting to see the kind of, you know, the kind of things on charts that you want to see with these breakouts to new all-time highs. And that silver cross index and the gold cross index are finally starting to respond. We're starting to see a little bit more participation across the board. I our one chart with those Swendland trading oscillators, and they tend to be pretty good predictors, that those negative divergences are still really a big concern for me.
And finally, Aaron, as we close, tell people about Stock Charts. It's, to me, one of the best charting software programs out there. My favorite go-to page every single morning is your market summary page, because I can look at the major indexes, the sectors, currencies, interest rates, commodities, you name it, you've guys got it. And the other thing I like, you've guys added a chart now. So before, where I had to click on the charts, I could just simply click on a tab and the chart appears immediately.
Absolutely. We continue to improve that homepage and offer that information right there, right at your fingertips. You know, I have a intraday chart list that I use. I can just go through 10-minute bar charts, bang, bang, bang. It's really great. You can set up what you need. And actually, they just have opened up a new charting platform. They call it the Advanced Charting Platform. And it's very similar to a lot of the competitors out there, where it's very interactive. You know, you can easily scroll into, you know, make the length of time bigger, shorter, have a bunch on the screen at the same time, put your favorite indicators in there. For those who aren't really interested in like static kind of charts and just saving a static chart. It's a really great platform that your viewers and listeners should probably check out. And of course, the articles by our commentary team are by far, I think, the best on the internet, to be perfectly honest. And most of all of that is for free. So as is the Decision Point blog right now. So
it's great, great stuff. If you'd like to find out about this or read Aaron's articles and others, as we've had on the program, Art Hill, you can do so by going to StockCharts, all one word, StockCharts.com. In my opinion, one of the best programs out on the market. Aaron, I want to thank you for joining us on the program.
Absolutely. Anytime. I love to come and talk about talk shop, as they say.
Okay. Well, listen, thanks for coming on. Have a great weekend.
Absolutely. You as well.
This week, we had the pleasure of speaking with Eric Townsend. He is the author of a book called Beyond Blockchain, The Death of the Dollar and the Rise of Digital Currency. We spoke with him originally last year, almost a year ago today, when he released his book, and we wanted to have him back on because just last week, President Xi Jinping out of China said that they want to pursue blockchain technology for their own purposes and also become the leading power in the use and implementation of blockchain for their own country. This was a major announcement. It caused a big spike in cryptocurrencies. So we had Eric on to discuss this, how this ties directly into his book about how national governments are pursuing very heavily a replacement to the US dollar as the world reserve currency. And the way that they're doing that is through digital currencies, specifically through the use of blockchain. So you'll definitely want to hear what he had to say on this week's program. Here's a clip of that interview.
The big deal of the next 25 years, I'm convinced. If you want to know, okay, what's the thing that's as big as the internet that's coming in the next 25 years? The question is, who is going to be in charge of re-engineering money itself? Not just making money work in, through digital payment systems, but redefining what money actually is in the form of digital currency. Who's in charge of that? Who controls that? Is this space race that I've talked about?
So if you aren't already a subscriber and would like to gain access to our FS Insider interviews that air 3 days during the week, all you have to do is go to financialsense.com and hit where it says subscribe.
Well, I guess one of the best things you can say about 2019 is just about everything is going up. Stocks are up, bonds are up, and even in certain places, commodities. Joining us from Bloomberg Markets is Mike McClone. Mike, let's talk about your views on commodities. You believe that gold prices are going to be heading higher. Let's talk about why that is the case, in that the 1500 level, which has been sort of resistance for gold, flips and now becomes support for gold. So let's begin with gold. Why do you see it heading higher?
Well, I guess we can start with keeping it simple, and that is Fed's easing. It's not complicated. Gold will rally and should continue to rally. It's not just the Fed easing. Interest rates globally around the world are plunging and have been plunging. So unless we expect those trends to reverse, i.e. interest rates start going up right away, bond yields, bond prices going down, bond yields going up, and or the Fed to reverse to tightening right away, it's unlikely that gold should do anything but continuing the trend. Now, gold is right now is having the best year since, I think it's 2010. It's up 16% on the year, and this is dollar terms. But it's already made new highs, all-time highs in terms of euro, in terms of British pound, the Canadian loonie, the Indian rupee, you name it. And to me, now, and those are some more of the major currencies. To me, it's just a matter of time. It does it in terms of dollars. The significant thing I think also to add is it's showing pretty good divergent strength compared to the dollar index. If you look at the trade-weighted broad dollar, which is our best measure I like to use of the dollar relative to commodities for an inverse correlation because it's based on trade, it's calculated by the New York Fed, that trade-weighted broad dollar, and this year it's actually up again. On a two-year basis, it's up 7%. And despite that, gold is up 17%. So when gold rallies in an environment the dollar strong, you have to ask yourself, what's it going to do when the dollar actually stops rallying? And that's why I see gold as nothing but higher. It's the one commodity quantity currency I would really like to not see go higher because you want to see things like the stock market outperforming. But that's another thing too. Gold's going up despite the stock market still making new highs. So one of the key things that really triggered gold to take off last year is when stock market volatility, i.e. the VIX, started inching higher.
So, Mike, is this somewhat unusual? Normally, when you see a dollar rallying and the stock market going up and with the S&P hitting a record this week, that is normally not the kind of environment you would see gold do well in.
It is not. The thing about gold is it has periods, obviously, of positive correlation to the stock market and periods of negative. But historically, it's zero. So that's where it comes in as a great diversifier. It's supposed to be zero to the S&P 500. What I was looking at this morning is doing a little more research is in periods when the gold actually goes up and the dollar is going up. And I haven't seen a similar case in a similar velocity since the early 90s. But this environment right now is unique, partly because we all know that gold is partly rallying because the Fed's easing, and we know the Fed's easing partly because stock market's picking up. Now, they might not say that, but that was my signal last year, and it seems to be working. So they're all kind of linked at the moment, and that's where I think the trigger now for gold to really accelerate is when the stock market stops going up or maybe declines. And that's been the case, Richie. Every single bottom we've had in gold, the most significant was August, September, October last year when the stock market had its first, it started its first 20% correction. That launched gold into the current bull market is in now. Gold was around 1,200. And as you mentioned earlier, it's around 1,500.
You had mentioned when the Fed started cutting interest rates, when they first started, the 1,400 was the first level. It took that out. And then obviously with these rate cuts this year, it took out 1,500. It's hovering roughly close to that. When you say or you think gold is heading higher, how high does it go? Do we go back to 2011 and take out the old highs?
Yes, it's a matter of time. The question is time. Now, we all know at some point, time could be a month, it could be 10 years. So that's not really helping people. But it's just one thing to always remember about gold. It's a good proxy for the dollar, i.e., dollar is a piece of paper. And you can measure the dollar versus other pieces of paper, but virtually every currency country in the world has behooves them to somewhat deflate that piece of paper, i.e., the longest currency or longest standing currency in the world is a British pound. And versus gold, it's lost 99% of its value. But it still is being used, i.e., you just have to put it into some form of investment like stocks and houses and earn an interest rate. So to me, it's just a matter of time. And it's just a question of how and when it does it. And I'm looking for next catalysts and triggers. So right now, short term, we have Fed easing tomorrow. That's basically a done deal. And then we have unemployment on Friday. And to me, it's how the stock market comes out of this period will potentially either launch gold into its next step of the rally. And I view this as just a step right now. It's going to take the next stair higher. And that is, it's hovering around 1,500. Right before the first cut, which was in July, it was around 1,400. And it just jumped to 1,500. So we've been basically unchanged now for 2 months, almost 3 months, which has allowed the moving averages, the overbought situations to catch up. And I think the key question we all should be asking ourselves is, what's it going to take for this gold rally to stop? And that's where I come back with some of the technicals. Before this rally this year, the gold market volatility, and I look at 260-day volatility, was the lowest in 20 years. So that's an indication that's ready to break out to a new movement. You look at things like Bollinger Bands from a two-year basis or one-year basis. They were also the narrowest in 20 years. So technically and fundamentally, gold is just breaking out. And I look at it as it needs a good reason to not go higher. And the Fed easing, and the rest of the world easing, and the Fed just catching up is probably a good reason for gold to keep going up. It needs typically the reason for gold to not go higher needs a period of like disinflation, which doesn't seem to be on the horizon at the moment.
So let's talk about some of the other commodities. The one commodity that has stood out this year, obviously, has been gold. If you take a look at some of the other commodities, what is that telling you, Mike? For example, taking a look at the downtrend in oil has had difficulty staying above 55. And then also if you're looking at copper, which has been down most of the year. So the downtrend of those two commodities, what is that telling you?
I think in the significance of those commodities, they're the most sensitive macroeconomic commodities. That's copper, i.e. the metal with the PhD in economics, and crude oil. And yes, they have supply and demand issues. But overall, right now, certainly in terms of start with crude oil, oversupply is the key factor. And it needs a good reason not to go lower in an oversupplied market, particularly when the global economy is slowing down. So one way to look at it is, I like to watch the 52-week average, and that is, to me, defines a trend, and I have to look at the reasons for that trend to either shift or to continue. Right now, the 52-week average in crude oil and copper turned down last year. It's been over a year now, they're heading lower. And I don't see a good reason for them to shift. My fear is they're going to accelerate. So one significant factor that is happening this month is something that most of us, our listeners and us, dreamed of when we were kids, and that is U.S. energy dependence in terms of liquid fuels is kicking in this month. If you look at the things I like to use, Department of Energy estimates of total liquid fuel consumption in this country, production is up 70% and is actually meeting and moving beyond liquid fuel consumption this year. The significance also is consumption of liquid fuels in this country is unchanged over the last 20 years. That's basically never happened in history of the world. Why? Technology. We're just advancing so fast. And why are we increasing production so much? It's technology. And I look at forward, where is that going? Energy and petroleum to me is becoming more just technology. I mean, I drive an electric car, I have electric panels on my house, and that's because they didn't subsidize. Look where that's 20 years from now. And then you look at things like metals, for instance, gold. There's only so much gold that can ever be produced. It's never really had more than 2% new supply on an annual basis, and that's always going to keep value for gold. But then you can bring on copper supply. But one also issue with switching over to copper, that trend also started heading lower last year with the global economy. It was one of the first metals to really correct and say there was a problem. And what I'm worried about, it's still hovering at last year's lows, despite the fact the stock market's made new highs. You know, the S&P 500. The stock market is a cold. Crude oil and copper should have much worse thicknesses.
Let's talk about copper for a minute, because we're going to this clean energy society, electric cars, solar panels on the house, which means more electric cars, more consumption of copper. It's my reading that copper is running an annual supply deficit. When do the fundamentals of that catch up with the price?
Yeah, that's where it's hard to measure. And I look at all the fundamentals, but the key thing that really drives copper, supply and demand is not as important, because prices will bring out supply and demand. And right now, the trend in copper since 2011 or so is down. It's just resuming that last year. One key thing that really brings on demand for copper is global economic demand pull growth. Like you mentioned, EVs, the economy growth, but this new technology is good for copper overall. You know, that's a good thing compared to like crude oil, where it's not being replaced by technology. Technology is creating more demand for copper. But now, for now, the overall picture remains of a bear market, global macroeconomic downside. And you mentioned, it's been bouncing lately. But one thing that's worrisome to me is copper is bouncing because we're having supply issues in Chile. There's political unrest, and that's oftentimes the worst thing you can do for a bull market, because it's a short-term supply constraint, which reduces demand. It brings on more supply. It actually usually hurts the overall fundamentals, which are pointing lower. Typically, for a good bull market in commodities or any market like that, you need good demand pull, and that's just not happening.
Let's turn our attention to 2020. It's a presidential election year. Obviously, the detractors from the president would love to see the economy weaken, because we know if you're in a recession or bear market, usually the incumbent loses. What role do you think next year's presidential election will have on the market cycle and the price of gold?
I think that's the key. You nailed it right there. The opponents of the incumbent know that they need to push the recession theme and theory and risks to upseat him. And a lot of the media is kind of left-winging and left-leaning. So that is, to me, the biggest risk, is that pushing this potential recession risk and fear hurts consumer confidence. And that's going to be the key factor. And it's also part of the reason I look forward to, I look a year ahead. So essentially, it's a year from now. If you put yourself a year from now, try to look back from the future, are we going to have more or less volatility in the stock market? I suspect it's going to continue to increase volatility. I'm not saying it can't go up, but the volatility should continue to increase. And is the global economic situation going to improve? Is consumer spending really going to take off more? I doubt it, because we're going to have a pretty contentious period. So I suspect, even with some detente in U.S.-China trade and the USMCA, which is a U.S.-Mexican-China trade agreement, there's still these underlying trends were in place before these trade wars. So I fear it's more likely we're going to have more of the same that we've had this year, i.e. gold higher, higher stock market volatility, and more likely to see these entrenched bear markets in crude oil continue lower. And also, one thing you have to note in there is we do have a sitting president who's made it clear that he has, it's his vested interest to have crude oil prices lower. So I respect that. This president certainly has a tendency to keep his promises. And he also has a vested interest from his constituents in keeping grain prices, or trying to get grain prices like corn and soybeans and wheat higher. Obviously, I do my analysis, but I factor those points in.
Well, you know, the one thing that markets hate are uncertainty, and whether it's a presidential tweet, something new on the impeachment front, and or the media pushing the recession narrative. I mean, you know, if you turn on the television every day, Mike, and you got some guy on TV talking about recession, 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 you know, sooner or later, that's going to have an impact on consumer confidence. People start to pull back, they spend less, and sometimes it can become self-fulfilling.
Yeah, I think that's what the bond market's telling us.
So given this, if you're an investor, if I could summarize this, probably one of the best plays going forward with volatility and the things that we just mentioned is probably going to be the gold market. Central banks, it's not just our central bank, but I think, what is it, in the third quarter, 26 central banks cut interest rates. You see that trend continuing. We're doing this interview on Tuesday, where it's widely expected on Wednesday the Fed will be cutting interest rates for the third time this year. Kind of interesting, Mike, to see they spent a whole year raising interest rates four times. There's speculation we may get a cut in December. So the following year, they reverse everything they did the previous year. And then now they're expanding their balance sheet to keep the markets liquid. So basically, they could undo QT.
Those are all good statements. And that is a key. There's a key quote from Stanley Fisher, who was former vice chairman of the Fed. His quote was that, I think he was actually quoting Einstein, yeah, the test's the same, but all the answers are different. And I think that's one problem with the Fed is that last year we were looking too much backward, and all my indicators were they should start easing now when they hiked in December. And most of it was because volatility was picking up in the stock market, and then bonds market, copper was collapsing, crude oil was collapsing. You're not supposed to raise an NBI, or at least supposed to sustain. And now they're just catching up. And I think, you know, the slow moving economy is just like you said, the media is pushing this recession theme. I have a complete respect for the bond market. You don't get, if you just look at bond yields a year ago, I mean, they've dropped by a third. That's U.S. bond yields. And of course, the rest of the world. And I look at it as you need to be expecting these trends to reverse in the next 365 days. And I don't see how that's going to happen. Maybe if we had a new president just get elected a month ago, yeah, that's potential, but I think it's unlikely. And so I think more defensive, and don't like being bullish gold, but I can't see how I can't be bullish. And I do look at 1500s becoming the next support pivot. And I suspect this next Fed ease will do it. And then so it's going to be how the stock market reacts. If the stock market starts wobbling, then that'll really boost gold. It typically does, because we know what a wobbly stock market does. It'll pressure the Fed to ease more.
All right. Well, listen, Mike, as we close, you guys do a great job at Bloomberg Markets, and especially yourself following the commodities market. How can our listeners follow your work?
Well, obviously, on the Bloomberg terminal, you can get all that, but I'm on LinkedIn. Happy that I'm looking me up on LinkedIn. It's all there. I put outlooks there. And if you just Google Bloomberg, like Commodity Outlook, once a month we publish our Commodity Outlook and we publish our Crypto Outlook. Those are available for the public on the web a few days after we publish. And of course, on LinkedIn, all my Cliff Note versions of all my stuff is available.
Well, listen, Mike, thanks for joining us on the program. Pleasure to have you back on.
Thanks for having me.
You bet. Bye bye.
Do you find yourself reacting to market news, selling when you should be buying, and buying when you should be selling? Are you making costly investment mistakes? It's time to take control and develop a plan that keeps your investments centered, no matter what direction the markets take. We can help you protect your investments during market downturns. and profit when markets rise. Contact Financial Sense Wealth Management to create an investment strategy today. Call 888-486-3939. That's 888-486-3939. Advisory services offered through Financial Sense Advisors Incorporated, a registered investment advisor. Securities offered through Financial Sense Securities Incorporated, member FINRA, SIPC. Both companies doing business as Financial Sense Wealth Management.
Today, we decided to lower the interest rates for the third time this year. We took this step to help keep the U.S. economy strong in the face of global developments and to provide some insurance against ongoing risks. As I will explain shortly, the policy adjustments we've made since last year are providing, and will continue to provide, meaningful support to the economy. We believe that monetary policy is in a good place. The U.S. economy is in its 11th year of expansion, and the baseline outlook remains favorable. The overall economy is growing at a moderate rate. Household spending continues to be strong, supported by a healthy job market, rising incomes, and solid consumer confidence. In contrast, business investment and exports remain weak, and manufacturing output has declined over the past year. Sluggish growth abroad and trade developments have been weighing on those sectors. Looking ahead, we continue to expect the economy to expand at a moderate rate, reflecting solid household spending and supportive financial conditions. The job market remains strong. The unemployment rate has been near half-century lows for a year and a half. The pace of job gains has eased this year, but has remained solid. We had expected some slowing after last year's strong pace. Participation in the labor force by people in their prime working years has been increasing, and wages have been rising, particularly for lower-paying jobs. People who live and work in low- and middle-income communities tell us that many who have struggled to find work are now getting opportunities to add new and better chapters to their lives. This underscores for us the importance of sustaining the expansion so that the strong job market reaches more of those left behind.
Well, that was Chairman Powell after the third rate cut with the Fed funds rate from 1.5% to 1.75%. Jim, I know that we were expecting the cut, but what's your read on this?
Well, Chris, if you take a look at everything that the Fed has had to do this year, we're calling this segment a reversal of fortune. Basically, the Fed is reversing every single thing they did last year. They raised rates four times, and the market is anticipating a fourth rate cut, whether it comes in December or January. They also are undoing everything they did with QT because the Fed will be adding $60 billion of liquidity into the market till the end of the second quarter of last year. So if you look at what they're doing, they're reversing every single thing they did in the last year. And the reason we got it this week, the third quarter GDP, it's still growing, slowed down to 1.9%, but we're not growing at 3%. And internationally, we are also seeing central banks cut. I think in the third quarter, 26 central banks cut interest rates, including our own Federal Reserve. The Bank of Brazil cut their interest rates by 50 basis points. And the reason, Chris, is the economies are slowing down globally. And quite honestly, the Fed can't afford to make a mistake. There's just too much in the market. There's too much corporate debt. There's too much government debt out there. And so basically, put it all into just one simple thing. They are undoing everything they did last year, which was one of the reasons why, as we were, you know, if our listeners think back to last year, the president was going bananas with his tweets and saying, Powell, what the hell are you doing? And as we pointed out, last year was the first time, at least I've seen, where you had the Fed working against fiscal stimulus, because normally fiscal stimulus and monetary stimulus ride in tandem. Think of 2009 QE and spending. So Trump put together fiscal stimulus to get the economy going, which was what happened. But then the Fed came in and said, you know what, we're going to throw a monkey wrench in this and start basically tightening.
Jim, why do you suppose they did that? I mean, we didn't have inflation. The economy wasn't overheating. I know they had mentioned that it's an attempt to stimulate the economy, but if the economy's not doing bad, we know that there's signs of a global economic slowdown, but is there something else behind all of this?
Well, it's kind of like, you remember that clip that we played? Oh, gosh, it's from The Office. It's a funny clip. And he goes, I can raise and lower my cholesterol at will. And so, you know, you're right. The economy wasn't overheating. Inflation was below the Fed target rates. There wasn't a bubble in the market. It was kind of like we want to reload the chambers so that if we do get into another pickle or another downturn, we'll have ammunition to fight. But here was the risk. By trying to reload the chambers so you'll have the ammunition to fight a downturn, you may end up causing a downturn, which is counterintuitive. And that's what I think the Fed realized and why they pivoted very quickly in January when they saw what happened in the fourth quarter. I mean, every asset class lost money. Stocks were down. Bonds were down. Commodities were down. It was just like, you know, people are saying, what the hell are you guys doing? If you recall last December, we did a show like one rate hike too far. And that's, in fact, what happened. So, Chris, basically, they were doing it to have enough ammunition. The next time we get another downturn, they would have the ability to lower interest rates. They still can. But in that process, they were on the road to creating a recession.
Well, after Friday's report, J.P. Morgan Chase and Barclays economists, they removed a projected fourth interest rate cut in December from a previous forecast. And I note, Jim, that there are some, I don't know if you'd call them storm clouds, but there does seem to be some concern on the horizon. Manufacturing activity did contract for a second month in October. Also, capital investment by businesses contracted at 3% annual rate in the third quarter after it already slipped 1% in the second quarter. So how does this tie in? Do you think that could be a big issue going forward?
Well, if you take a look at much of what you're seeing on the manufacturing side has a lot to do with this trade war between the U.S. and China. And now China seems to be backing off, sensing weakness on the president's negotiating ability as a result of impeachment proceedings this week. So a lot of what you're seeing in business investment has a lot to do with the trade war, Chris. But the one thing that's driving this economy is consumers. We've got the lowest unemployment in 60 years. Wages are rising again. We don't have real wage inflation, but the good news is workers are getting pay increases. And so they're spending money, and that's reflected in retail sales. And that's what's driving the economy, because a little over almost close to three quarters of the U.S. economy is based on consumption. So it isn't business investment, and you can't blame business. Right now, global supply chains are being rearranged. A lot of businesses are saying, you know, we don't know where we need to relocate factories based on this trade war. So manufacturing has gone into contraction, and that certainly is having an impact on the economy. I think it was the Federal Reserve out of San Francisco that said that the trade war probably knocked off about 0.75% off U.S. GDP. So we'd be closer to 3% without the trade if business was kicking in. But right now, there is no sign anywhere of a recession here. There are some numbers that we need to keep an eye on, especially consumers. But as long as consumers are spending, getting wage increases, and we're creating jobs, that should be enough to carry the economy going forward.
Jim, what do you make of the bond market? You know, we're noticing the yield curves flattening, but also on Friday, U.S. government bond yields rose. I'm just curious, do you think that the bond market thinks the Fed's making a mistake here?
The bond market is saying the Fed is making a mistake. You've got a flattening of the curve. The Fed was hoping by cutting interest rates. And remember, over the last month, we saw interest rates from August when they got down to roughly about 1.4%. They started to back up and it looked like they got up to almost 1.9%. They've come down. And this week, we're closer to 1.7. The bond market is saying the Fed is making a mistake here. And it'll be interesting because the Fed tends to follow what the markets are doing. As Tom McClellan basically said last week, if the Fed would just listen to the market, they'd be making better decisions. But these guys are PhDs, in economics, and they think they know more than the markets, which they don't. So right now, the bond market is saying the Fed has made a mistake, which means, I want to go back to something that came out of this meeting. They removed a very important few words. I mean, we're very big on parsing the language of the Fed. And basically what they did, Chris, is they removed the item that they are basically going to just monitor things going forward. What they removed is the lines, as the committee contemplates the future path of the target range for federal funds rate, it will continue to monitor the implications, and they removed, will act as appropriate to sustain the expansion. It was that language, they will act as appropriate, that gave the bond market and the futures market the probability that the Fed would actually cut rates this week, which is what they did. So what the Fed is trying to do here is, by removing that language and saying, we'll just monitor things, is they want to make sure they alert the markets, hey guys, we've cut three times. This is a mid-cycle slowdown. We are now going to go on pause. So that's why they removed that language, because they didn't want the market participants saying, hey, in December, they're going to cut again. Now, the bond market, on the other hand, disagrees what the Fed just did. The bond market is saying the Fed just made a mistake by saying that, and they'll end up cutting, which is what I think they'll end up doing again.
Well, it's interesting here because the stakes seem so high, particularly in a presidential election cycle. We've already heard previous news about whether the president was putting pressure on the Fed or whatever. But I was reading an article today. It was really interesting because Gary Polak, he's the head of bond trading at Deutsche Bank Private Wealth Management. He said that unexpected labor market strength could lead economists to increase their forecasts for growth in the third and fourth quarters. He said that this makes the Fed look pretty smart. Further, he said rate cuts really aren't justified. The economy's not slowing as much as people thought. Do you agree with Gary Polak? I mean, does this end up making the Fed look smart?
You know, I would have to say they handled this rate cut with market expectations very well. We didn't get any of the disappointments like we did last year, where the Fed would have a meeting and then they would say something that was more hawkish, the market would sell off, and of course everybody remembers what happened in the fourth quarter. We're following LAIs, and we think global LAIs are bottom and now turning up. So we could see an upswing in 2020, barring something that we can't foresee right now. So I would probably go along with that, because our indicators are telling us that global LAIs have bottomed and are now ticking up. But what are we saying? It's not just the Fed that's cutting. There were 26 interest rate cuts in the third quarter by central banks. So it's not just us, Chris. It's happening globally. Central banks are cutting interest rates, and that should act as insurance, and we should see economic growth pick up. Now, let's talk about economic growth. There's two sides of that. There's government spending, which is accelerating faster than the rate of tax revenues. So government spending is increasing. The Fed has cut interest rates, and consumers are spending. As long as those things remain in force and that trend continues, we should see economic growth pick up.
So with consumer spending, obviously we're approaching the holiday spending. What percentage do you think is dependent upon the consumer carrying the ball here?
Well, I think they are carrying the ball, that and government. In fact, Apple just reported robust earnings. They beat expectations on the top and bottom line. They've upped their forecast for the fourth quarter, which is Apple's actually first quarter in their fiscal year. And they're expecting a booming holiday season. And most retailers are too, because the consumers are feeling confident. They're working. They're getting wage increases. We're at the lowest unemployment in six decades. So I would expect that we would see a very good holiday season. It'll be interesting to see who participates, whether it's brick and mortar or it's mainly online retailers. But even the retailers, Chris, are changing their focus. Nordstrom is changing some of their stores to have pickup centers, and they're trying to emphasize their online marketing. Walmart is doing the same. Target's doing the same. Costco's doing the same. So they're trying to bridge that gap. And it's kind of war against Amazon now. So I expect a robust Christmas season.
Oh, I had mentioned a moment ago about the stakes being very high as it relates to the Fed and us being in a presidential election cycle. The Wall Street Journal had an article out that talked about the election and how both sides are framing this election in apocalyptic terms. Now, it could be, you could make the argument that every election, they do the same kind of thing. But it is interesting right now when we talk about the economy, because President Trump has declared, quote, at stake in this fight is the survival of American democracy itself. And then former Vice President Joe Biden told audiences that reelecting Mr. Trump will, quote, fundamentally change the character of this country for generations, end quote. Well, one thing that you and I were talking about off the air, Jim, I wanted our listeners to benefit from this. There was some research done, and you sort of have to take everything that's online with a grain of salt. But if this is true, I think it's very telling about elections and recessions and whether or not someone's going to have a second term. But from what I was looking at, it showed that all the way from 1916 to the present, if I'm reading this correctly, that if there was no recession in the 2 years before an election, there was always a presidential re-election. And if there was a recession in the 2 years before the election, no re-election, with the exception being Calvin Coolidge in 1924. Now, Jim, if this data is correct, I can see why the president, the administration, everyone is really hanging with bated breath on all of these numbers and whether or not we're going into recession. Obviously, you don't want a recession if you're looking for a re-election, but it looks like a recession could be almost a guaranteed loss.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, just go back to 2008 when McCain was running against candidate Obama. We were in the worst recession since 1974, a bear market that was devastating, a financial crisis. So what happens in an election year if the economy is booming, unemployment is low, people are feeling happy? It's kind of like don't change horses in midstream. So the incumbent tends to get reelected. On the other hand, if it's in a recession and we're in a bear market, well, the opposition team says, look, see what this guy did? He ruined the economy. Elect us and we'll fix it. And that's just the way politics plays out. The guy in the White House, if the economy's doing well, he gets credit for it. If the economy isn't doing well, he gets blamed for it. So you can understand why Trump last year was furiously tweeting to Powell, like, what the heck are you trying to do by raising interest rates and cutting back on your balance sheet and cut back? And it turned out they went too far, as we had a spike in the repo rates in September from 2 to 10%, and the Fed has had to reverse course on QT, and now they're injecting liquidity. Basically, Wall Street ran out of money last month. And so a lot of this is being corrected. It tends to play out, Chris. I use the term, don't change a horse in midstream, which is what politicians tend to run if you're the incumbent. They tend to say, hey, look, the economy's good. You have a job. Your wages are going up. That's me. Why would you want to get rid of me and go to the other guy? On the other hand, if things are going bad, the opposition team is going to say, look how bad of a job this guy has done. Elect us and we'll fix it. So I think the outcome to next year's election rests on the economy.
Well, it's interesting that over the last 103 years that there's only been one exception to whether or not someone loses re-election based on the recession. So it's very, very interesting. But speaking of politics, something very interesting happened yesterday, and that was that the House passed an impeachment resolution, and it was the first significant vote since the probe began into Trump's call for the Ukraine to investigate Joe Biden. Jim, what are the implications of this impeachment resolution and the impeachment process?
You know, Chris, it's election maneuvering. I mean, what are the Democrats going to run against the president on? They can't run against the president on the economy because the economy is, you know, once again, the lowest unemployment rate in 60 years. And number two, the Republicans control the Senate. You got to have a two-thirds majority. A lot of this stuff is done behind closed doors. It's not going to go anywhere. It's more for political theater than anything else. But it is impacting the trade negotiations. The Chinese are kind of pulling back, and you can't blame them. The president is weakened in his negotiating ability as a result of impeachment. So they're pulling back and saying, I don't think we can get a long-term plan. Quite honestly, they're hoping that, you know, somebody else gets into office, a Democrat, which will be much easier on the Chinese than this president. Nobody has been this tough on the Chinese, and they're hoping for a different outcome in 2020. So the only immediate impact will probably be on the trade front. But other than that, this is just political theater.
Well, Jim, we started the show talking about the rate cuts. What do the rate cuts mean for the average person? I mean, we've got a rise in the dollar. We've got a fall in oil prices. All of this seems to factor into what appears to be a subdued pace of inflation this year. But for the average investor, what do these rate cuts mean?
You know what this is doing, Chris? It's, you know, typically, what does the rate cut mean? Well, by cutting the interest rate, typically you're seeing this reflected in mortgage rates. The 30-year fixed mortgage rate is now 3.75%, according to Freddie Mac. And that reflects this lowering of interest rates that the Fed has begun since this summer. But typically you would also see credit cards go down as well. But according to the Wall Street Journal, credit card rates are not going down, or I guess the best thing you could say is they're not going up. The average credit card is 17% interest. Now, who else is this going to impact? Well, auto loans, which are usually five-year auto loans, they are down to 4.6%. So two big spending sectors for consumers, housing and autos, are being helped by these lower interest rates. But the one group that will not get any benefit are student loans. Student loans, unfortunately, are less affected. Federal loan interest rates are set every May based on the 10-year Treasury auction. So it's not going to help anybody going forward, at least over the next 12 months, if you're taking a student loan. Who else is impacted by this? Well, savers are. The average one-year CD rate is a little over 0.5%, and some of these bigger interest rate accounts have dropped down below 2%. So savers are going to get impacted by this as rates head lower, bond rates head lower. I mean, we started out 10-year treasuries were at 3.25% in January. They're now down about 1.7%. So if you're an income investor, this is not good news. And that's why we like high dividend paying stocks, is because the yields on dividends are much higher than what you can get in the bond market, something we haven't seen probably in 40 and 50 years. So lower mortgage rates, lower auto loans, but lower interest rates on interest producing vehicles. Everything from treasury bills to CDs to bonds are heading lower, which is not good news for a lot of retirees or pension plans.
Based on that, Jim, what are you guys doing here at the firm?
You know, we've gone more into international because we were using some ETFs there. We think that that sector has bottomed out. We like dividend paying stocks. We've been getting yields anywhere from 4 or 5, and we're looking at a couple 6 and 7% yields. I do think the Fed is not done cutting. I think that there will be another interest rate cut. Whether it comes in December or January will depend on what the data looks like and how well this fourth quarter plays out, especially with retailers for the Christmas season. So we're looking at yield and we're looking international, and we have gone from below neutral to neutral and increasing in our equity weightings as a result of seeing what we're seeing with the LEIs, which we think have bottomed globally.
Well, Jim, what do you see coming up in the weeks ahead?
Coming up in the weeks ahead, we're still kind of working our way through earnings season. But now, Chris, we're entering into the holiday season. So look for what retailers are going to say, what their expectations are for this fourth quarter. We're going to see if the consumer carries the ball into the goal line at the end of the year, which we expect to see. I mean, Apple just came out with robust earnings. They just upped their forecast for the fourth quarter. New product line, it's going well. Wearables are doing well for Apple. So we would be watching the retailers as a sign of strength and confirming the consumers are going to carry the ball into the finish line the fourth quarter. In the meantime, on behalf of Chris Prytower and myself, we'd like to thank you for joining us here on the Financial Sense News Hour. Until you and I talk again, we hope you have a pleasant weekend.
Financial Sense News Hour is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the News Hour each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of the Financial Sense staff and do not take into account listener suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Financial Sense News Hour and its parent company shall not be liable for any financial losses that result from investing in any companies mentioned in Financial Sense or arising out of the use of any material on the News Hour. Be advised that you invest at your own risk.